from JEA to Lot J to transparency around the vote count. Voters and community leaders this week say Jacksonville is simply on the wrong track. Good Monday morning. We're live on this election eve from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll tell you why civic leaders are speaking out about what they call a crisis of confidence in Jacksonville's leadership. Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Then later, tomorrow's the big day. We've got a look at the latest presidential election forecast, one day before November 3rd, when America picks its president. But first this hour, the latest on the coronavirus pandemic. More than 99,000 COVID infections were reported across the U.S. Friday, setting a single-day record for cases as the nation's outbreak continues to spiral out of control. Here in Florida Friday, we just surpassed 800,000 cases of COVID with a death toll just below 17,000 people. The bottom line, the virus is spreading. That is the message here. So continue to be vigilant. Continue to wear a mask. Continue to socially distance as much as you can and avoid crowded indoor gatherings. That is the best we can do right now. Some other news to get into right now, though. The civic group Our Jacks is the latest to add its voice to growing criticism of the Jaguars' proposal to develop Lot J. Now, they're calling this Lot J deal, which involves hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer money, part of a failure of governance in this city, along with the crisis over selling JEA and the recent flap over the county's canvassing board looking at votes leading up to Election Day and ballots. We have two great guests to break all this down for us as we welcome on the line Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci. Councilman, good morning.
Good morning. Beautiful day.
Good to have you. Also with us, Attorney Audrey Moran, one of the leaders of the civic group Our Jacks. Audrey, good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Already getting your calls. We're going to begin with a Lot J discussion, everyone. Call us up now at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open as well. Councilman Carlucci, you recently co-hosted a town hall with your colleague Randy DeFore, and you got an earful last week from the public about the proposal to develop Lot J, the parking lot next to the Jaguar Stadium. You got some pretty tough feedback. Voters saying the deal is too generous, too favorable to the team owner, Shad Khan, a billionaire. Voters think this would come at the expense of other big quality of life issues in this city that have gone unaddressed for a long time. And so what's your response, first off, to the feedback about Lot J?
Well, I think it has set the table for the debate to begin. And I was also, I got to tell you, I thought the meeting, Councilmember DeFore and I wanted the meeting to be very fair for the Jaguars. And we wanted it to be a time for the public to have its say, to speak. But, you know, they spoke, I think, with great sincerity. There was no emotional lashing out. It was all questions. They were good questions. They asked some really good questions that I think kind of frames the debate going in to this Thursday when we have the council committee as a whole. So I think the town meeting really kind of set it off on a good foot. It may not have been everything that the Jaguars wanted to hear, but at least they heard what the people are concerned about and take that into consideration as they as we move about these negotiations and so forth. So I was proud of the town meeting. I thought it was fabulous. I thought it turned out great.
Audrey Moran, you're a former chair of the Downtown Development Authority, former chief of staff to Mayor John Delaney when the Better Jacksonville plan was rolled out. That was with a lot of taxpayer money. You're a former candidate for mayor. You are a founding board member of the Government Accountability and Civic Group, Our Jacks. You are choosing to speak out about the Lot J deal and some other recent issues around this city. Let's begin with Lot J. What are your concerns?
So thanks, Melissa. My concerns are very similar to what we're hearing all over the city. First of all, we need to make sure that the deal is fair to the taxpayers. We need to understand what the economic development impact is going to be. As has been reported widely, the economic development figures that the administration has relied on to try to sell this project came from the developer itself. We have no one representing the taxpayers' interests in this deal. And that's why it's so important when Councilman Carlucci, Councilwoman DeFore, and others stand up and ask the tough questions. Our JACS is committed to integrity, transparency, and accountability in government. We want to applaud our legislators who stand up for the people and ask the hard questions. And we want to make sure that we don't have a done deal presented to the council without the right questions being asked. We have to know what this deal is about. We have to know that it's the best use of our taxpayer dollars. And I think there's a lot more questions to be asked before we have those answers.
Councilman Carlucci, we are looking at more than $230 million in taxpayer subsidies for Mr. Khan's mixed-use development. Some of your colleagues on the council have expressed concern about the NFL franchise not committing to a lease extension if the city buys all in on Lot J. Should the city be taking a harder negotiating line?
Well, let me tell you what I think this is about. It's what my dear friend Audrey Moran said. It's about transparency, transparency, transparency. It's about protecting the taxpayer, protecting the taxpayer. But I think at the very least of concessions, extending the lease agreement is critical, at least in my view, as to what most council members want to see. I want to see a lease agreement extended, but I also want to know what the sustainability and viability of this development will be. Will it be a flash in the pan, or will it be a development that can sustain itself for many years to come? So to Audrey's point about having another look, I hope to file today or late today or maybe early in the morning a bill that I've been working on for a good while that would bring in a company that in a short period of time, because of the timetable that's been set, a third party outside view of this agreement, what the return of investment could be, and looking over the whole developed agreement in finding out, in letting us know from their point of view, is the market viable for this agreement? I mean, for this development. We don't know what the, now I don't know if this company will be able to do this or not, but we don't know what the actual construction costs are. I've asked for that, and I've asked for backup material. What's the cost of the environmental cleanup? I have no idea what that cost is, but they say we can do all the infrastructure, including environmental, for $77 million. Well, that's $77 million of the taxpayers' money. I'd kind of like to make sure if those are the right numbers. And then the other thing is, how does this contract, how does this development agreement stack up with other cities with Cordish? And I think that's something that we should look at on behalf of our taxpayers.
Audrey Moran, as we talk about the Lot J proposal, your group, RJAX, is pointing to the controversy around taxpayer money for Lot J is part of a pattern. What you say is the recurring flaunt of ethics among Jacksonville public officials. You cited the failed plan to sell JEA, what you call a flawed proposal to develop Lot J, and also the violation of judicial ethics rules by the chair of the Duval County Canvassing Board. A judge was forced to step down from that board last week when it was revealed that he had made a number of donations to Donald Trump for president and displayed Trump-Pence signs at his home. You call all of this a systemic failure of the culture of governance in Jacksonville. Strong words. Can you elaborate a little bit on why our JACS is taking this position?
Sure. Our JACS came together 1 year ago when the Times Union and Councilwoman DeFore, Councilman Carlucci, Councilwoman Brenda Priestley Jackson started sounding the alarm that this was not a good deal for the citizens, that this was a deal that was less than transparent, was good for the executives of JEA, and was being rushed through the governmental process. And what ARJAC did was say, no, we're going to pull together over 500 community citizens and say, our voices do matter. We're not going to accept things like this as a done deal, and we're going to stand up what's right for our community and for our city. And so what we learned from JEA was, and ARJAC, was that when people come together and speak up and speak out, you can make a difference. You absolutely can stop what looked like a freight train running down the tracks in selling JEA and say, no, we need to take a harder look. We need to ask the tough questions, and we need to support our city council people when they do that. And you know what? It worked. And so people said, wow, I can have a voice. I can make a difference. And now we're looking, not very much later, less than a year later, we're looking at what was reported as a done deal. When the Lot J deal was first announced, when the press conference was held, we were told there were 13 votes. We were told there was no economic due diligence. We're going to rely on the developer. And that this is done, everybody. And you know what? ARJAC was founded on the principle that people do have a voice and a role in government that is important. And again, we have certain council people like Matt Carlucci who have a strong backbone. It is very hard to stand up against this deal. And I do want to say ARJAC is in no way against the Jaguars or against Shad Khan. We love being an NFL city. And quite frankly, I love Shad Khan's positions on social justice and equity. He's done some good things. But on this side of the deal, it doesn't seem to ARJAC like we've had a voice, like there has been somebody negotiating for the taxpayers. And so Councilman Carlucci's idea of bringing in an objective third party to tell us what's good about this deal, and I'm sure there's some things that are good, but also what's not so good and what can be improved, we're going to get a much better bang for our taxpayer dollar. You know, Melissa, you asked about the canvassing board as well. And, you know, it's part of a trend that is very concerning. I love Jacksonville. I know Matt Carlucci loves Jacksonville. This is a fabulous city in so many ways. But we have had a black eye in the national media for lack of transparency, lack of integrity, and lack of accountability, starting with JEA and most recently with the canvassing board. We have got to be able to turn that culture in government around. We've got to have leaders like Matt Carlucci and Randy DeFore and Brenda Priestley Jackson saying enough. We need honesty. We need transparency. And we don't, ARJAC also believes we don't have to agree with every decision made in government. We just want to be sure they're made in the sunshine and they're made with the taxpayers' interests at heart.
Lots of calls for attorney Audrey Moran of the civic group ARJAC and Councilman Matt Carlucci, our guest this morning, as we talk about the Lot J deal and some other issues that have flared up recently in this city. Give us a call now, 549-2937. Cynthia along the Ortega River. Hello, Cynthia. Good morning.
Hello.
Go ahead.
My concern, there have been two. My concern is that the Metro Park was developed 40 years ago by some very wise people who applied for a grant in order for it to be developed. They recognized the fact that those people who live on the outside fringe of Springfield and also in the area near the stadium had a need for a recreational area, and then the urban park was established with that money from the grant in perpetuity, and that it would be considered, that would be ignored, I think, shows a lack of respect for those people that had a vision then for something very good for Jacksonville that has helped and enhanced the quality of life of those people who have been using it. In addition to that, the greater community had used it until we were shut out for in the water boat shows, for the jazz festival, for the Shakespeare in the Park symphony at night, Starry Nights concerts. And we've been shut out from Metro Park for the last 3 years while this back in the background negotiation was being done. And Metro Park is but in the Greater Jacksonville plan had a kids campus that was developed that it was being used by children that was wonderful. I know that schools use Jacksonville, use the urban park, for Oh, thanks. When they come to the fire museum, it seems to me that also my other concern is to gift Lot J to someone is devaluing property. Property is something that we cannot replace. It is owned by the city of Jacksonville. It seems to me that it would be better to create a passive green space until such time as a person who has enough of a commitment to Jacksonville that they would want to put all of their resources into purchasing whatever and fully funding whatever they wanted to build at that time to consider, because that person exists. It might be 20 years from now, but to be able to recognize the fact that that has value, and I'm so glad the Museum of Science and History is moving to the shipyards. I think it'll greatly enhance the whole area.
Yeah. All right, Cynthia. Thanks. Cynthia calling from Ortega. Councilman, lots of concerns expressed by that constituent. What are your thoughts?
I have the same concerns.
Okay.
I mean, we're right now, I'm neck, up to my neck in Lot J, but I have also been concerned about Metropolitan Park, the shipyards, the exchange of the two. How far has that gone along? You know, one of the things that has been difficult, and I've never experienced this, and by the way, I want to say before I go any farther, I'm switching gears here for a second, but I'm so thankful that Audrey Moran and the group RJAX is not, you know, I think their mission was JEA, and I think they found out their mission hadn't ended and was still needed. And it is so helpful to a council member to not be out on that diving board plank all by themselves trying to tackle a big issue. You've got to have people behind you. You've got to have, and RJAX has been a great resource for good government in Jacksonville.
Yeah.
And I just applaud Audrey and Michael Ward and all the others.
And let me ask you about this, because this organization that Audrey is representing has sprung up because there are concerns about leadership. I want to ask you, because we have an email here from a listener saying they don't believe that in the end, the city council will ever tell Shad Khan and the Jaguars no. Now, you told the Times Union the other day the Lot J deal would be easier to support if Shad Khan could be convinced to extend his lease with the city, but you did concede that Mr. Khan has the upper hand. You said, I think it will be tough to vote no, but I think it's reasonable to ask for concessions. Why is it so tough to vote no if the majority of your constituents are telling you that that's what they want?
Well, let me say this. I might have reworded that differently. I think the majority, matter of fact, I know the majority of the citizens are not supporting this now. But I voted on three or four big Jaguar bills before, and they're always tough because you got critics that are always going to be there, and then you got folks that want the city to progress. And I just remember hearing somebody say one time that used to be mayor, well, Matt, good luck. The NFL usually wins, though, you know. I thought, well, might be a little truth to that. But here's the thing, though. This is different because we've got RJAX. We've got so many people that expressed concerns that were framed at the town meeting that I think there's got to be some concessions. It may not. This one may not pass. And I will also say that one of those big bills I voted on was a lot of improvements to the to our football stadium, the whatever stadium it is now. And guess what? The Weavers extended their lease. It can be done. But we got to have people that really want to commit to Jacksonville, the city we love, the city we believe in, the city we believe it can become. But you've got to have a commitment from both sides. They may argue this commitment is fair. I'm not so sure. I think it's lopsided. And without a lease extension, it might draw more no votes. But then there's a lot of pressure that comes in voting for a Lot J type of project. And I don't want to go into a lot of the reasons why, because I don't want to go there. I think people use their imaginations will hit it on the head. But we've got to have independent thinking on this as much as possible to listen. I'd love to see Lot J go in. All of that sounds and looks wonderful. It's amazing. I love the Jaguars. A season ticket holder. Shad Khan has done some really great things, investments. What he's done for social justice in Jacksonville, as Audrey alluded to. So that's not really the case. The case is this a sustainable deal for Jacksonville? And, you know, it might be for a while, but I don't want to see a flash in the pan and then all of a sudden it's not being sustainable. And I think we ought to ourselves to have some outside view of that. But it is hard to vote against these because your heart wants something really nice for your city. You're getting a lot of pressure, a lot of political pressure.
Give me an example of how that shakes out. What happens?
What are you referring to?
When you experience political pressure in voting, in potentially casting a vote against the Jacksonville Jaguars' desire to develop Lot J with hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money in the middle of a pandemic and a recession, what would be an example of pressure placed on you, Matt Carlucci, or your colleagues?
Melissa, I really don't feel much pressure. Perhaps when I was in my younger years, I might have felt more pressure because I wanted the support of the Jaguars and feeling like you want the Shad Khan endorsement and so forth and so on. I don't feel any. I feel more pressure to make sure I'm doing the right thing and I can lay my head down on the pillow and sleep decent.
Okay, but what would be an example of pressure some of your colleagues might face? Would your colleagues be pulled into a room or a phone call and said, look, if you don't vote the way we want you to, we're going to elaborately fund an opponent against you when you're up for reelection? Is that what goes on? Is that an example?
Well, I think that can happen. And I'm not going to point to specifics, but that problem's been around for a long time, mm-hmm. That type of political pressure. But it seems to have intensified the meanness of campaigns. My friend Scott Wilson just got butchered, and he is a good man. And you know what? A good man, a good public servant at Jacksonville, to have that happen to him, in my opinion, was as offensive as I've ever seen.
Yeah, and if I could, let me bring Audrey Moran back into the discussion because Audrey, Councilman Carlucci is referring to his now former colleague on the city council, Scott Wilson, who did run afoul of some particularly nasty backroom politics that unfortunately is a hallmark of this city. What are your thoughts about this whole dynamic that we've been referring to here?
Well, Matt Carlucci is being the gentleman that he always is, but I will just be a little bit more direct. People get pulled into rooms and told, you vote this way or else. And the or else is, we'll run an opponent against you, or we simply won't support you, or we know you've got other political ambitions, and they're not going to come true. So make it easy on yourself. And that happens all the time. That is why groups like Our Jacks are so important, to give people cover, to give people backbone, to give people the feeling that there are other people out there saying, you're doing good work, you have our voice, you have our support. And it's only until we know that people can really be heard in our community when transparency and the culture of integrity return to our city. I think that's what's really important is we have got to be able to know that deals that come before the city council are well negotiated. And that is why Matt's idea of having an outside party tell us what works and what doesn't makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. But you know what? That won't sail through council. It should. But some are going to say, no, we don't need that. We do need that. This project was negotiated by the chief of staff for the mayor, who is a very good politician, but not an economic development specialist. And you better believe that Shad Khan had the best development specialist on his side of the table. We need somebody to give this an objective look and report back to the council so they can make an informed decision.
And let me, let me get a few comments on the air from our Facebook page as Siobhan writes, do I have this correctly? So many comments. Let me break these down. Stand by a minute. Siobhan, I think we keep doing the things that are neither requested nor as effective to rebuild downtown. Martha, can't we build up other areas of town? Susan, why should the taxpayer subsidize billionaires? Robert, I'm not against Lot J being developed. I'm disappointed in how boring the buildings look like they're going to be. Susan, was the sale of JEA to get money for Lot J? Let's see, is there any more comment? I'm looking at some more comments. Michelle, just another giveaway to rich people at the expense of everyone else. The mayor is a liar and a bully. People are fired up about this. An email from Diane. Cons, smoke, and mirrors remind me of what Donald Trump did in New York back in the 80s and 90s. There's a sucker born every minute. Con sees Jacksonville is ripe for the pickings, he says. A tweet from Kevin. Getting a lease concession doesn't fix the numbers on the Lot J deal. An independent analysis is critical. Okay, so Matt Carlucci, we're getting an earful from listeners out there. The city council is meeting on November 5th, and you are going to reveal more at that time about an independent analysis to look at the viability of this project. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. If the bill is complete, it should be complete. I will, because we'll be in committee. We'll be doing committee work. I will do my best along with the council auditors. By the way, the biggest team and the greatest team we have for transparency and for scrutiny is council auditors. We should never forget. We've got the greatest team of the greatest watchdog of the city, the city of Jacksonville citizens in the council auditor's office. So they are going to be very independent, and that's huge. But we wanted an independent kind of a development type of view on this, and along with the numbers that the auditors will provide us. But I think the auditors are probably our best ally in trying to make sure this is fair. I mean, you know, all I want to do is be fair. I want people to feel they've been treated fairly and not feel like we're always having to give away the store to get whatever we want. So I just want, fairness. I want transparency. I can't just look at the Cordish study and say, okay, that's good enough for me, because it's not really backed up with any independent numbers. So we're kind of getting one view. So fair, it's just a matter of fairness.
Audrey.
So Melissa, one point that has yet to be made that I think is important is this is not a downtown project. If it was a downtown project, the Downtown Investment Authority would have taken an expert look at it, brought in negotiators, and talked about the economic development consequences. That didn't happen because it's not downtown. So when you hear people say, this is going to help spur downtown, no, we're creating a whole new district. And there's been such a lack of focus on really developing the core of downtown. That has been why nothing has happened. We continue to see something bright and shiny, and we move out and race toward it. We need focus on core downtown if you want real downtown redevelopment. The other thing that is important is something that the Times Union said, which is, how does this fit with the Riverfront Parks Now initiative? That's a group of about six different coalitions who are working really hard for a master plan for our riverfront that could really work and be something along the lines of Chattanooga or other cities that has been wildly successful. How does it fit with that plan? That's something government has never been very good at. We look at projects in a silo. We need to be looking at as part of an overall plan, and that refers to the woman who called earlier about the parks and Metro Park. How does it fit together?
Right. Yeah. And
Go ahead, and then we'll wrap up. Go ahead, Councilman.
Well, I forgot to get back to. I went off sidetrack there on the nice lady who called in about Metropolitan Park. That's going to be a whole other chapter, and really we need to start digging into it now. I have. I'm sure some of my colleagues have as well. But that park was to be there for forever. Right. It was a promise, and I know things can change, but only if it's done in a way that respects the intent of the original Metropolitan Park Agreement with the feds.
We want to thank you both so much for joining us this morning, City Councilman Matt Carlucci and Attorney Audrey Moran of Our Jacks. And we'll continue to follow it. Thank you again, and have
You're
a great
welcome.
Week.
Thank you.
Well, The Economist presidential election forecast is out this week, and it gives Joe Biden the greatest chance to become America's next president. There is a lot to get into once you look inside their numbers and their methodology. I spoke about it all with data journalist Elliot Morris of The Economist. Let's listen. Elliot Morris, good to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And as we get closer to Election Day, lots of traffic at the Economist website where you update your presidential forecast daily. As I'm looking at it, you have Joe Biden heavily favored to beat Donald Trump, both in the popular vote and in the Electoral College. Can you tell us a little bit about your model and how you put it together?
Sure. Well, our election model just tries to do two overall things. First, we want to put the candidates' positions in a historical context using the various what we call fundamental indicators or measures of the way the national political environment might be leaning. So we crunch economic data and data on the president's approval rating to figure out this year that he starts from a pretty disadvantaged position in the election. And then secondly, and perhaps much more useful now at the end of the election cycle, we want to know what could happen if the election polls themselves are wrong and how wrong specifically they might have to be for Joe Biden or Donald Trump to win the election. So today, after we do our polling aggregation, our fancy averaging, right, we find that Joe Biden is up by about 9 percentage points nationally, and he's up 7% or so in the tipping point state in Pennsylvania. And so our model looks at the historical distribution of polling error, right? How wrong polls have been in the past. And it says, okay, well, how often have we seen 7 percentage point errors? And it tells us, it spits back a number. It says, actually not that likely. And so the conclusion it reaches based on repeating that process in every state is that it's not very likely that Donald Trump would win the election.
Yeah. Now, as you have this project laid out on your website, there are a number of data visualization tools you've used and graphics that people can look at. You even have a map of the U.S. where you can hover your cursor over each state and look at how each state is likely to go. For example, as I hover my cursor over the state of Florida, and it's 29 electoral votes, I learned that you give Joe Biden a 78% chance of winning Florida, a 4-in-5 chance. So everyone is watching these state results and numbers closely. All of that said, even though you don't give the president much of a chance of winning, he still does have a chance to win. So let's talk about that scenario, the paths that the president could win another term.
Yeah, like you said, we've identified a few paths that aren't very likely, but that he could still take to victory. And Florida is probably the jumping off point for that path, right? With its 29 electoral votes and Trump's roughly 25% chance or 4-in-5 chance of winning there. If he wins in Florida, which would be quite a big upset, then he's also maybe on the path toward overperforming expectations in Pennsylvania, the next closest state that he would need, as well as North Carolina and Arizona, where he won last time, but is also favored sort of to lose right now and would need to win for the election. And if he gets all four of those states, and he's holding, you know, and he's holding on to everything else he won last time, then that's the ball game right there, you know. So basically, if Joe Biden can win Michigan and Wisconsin, but nothing else, then Trump still stays president. But that's again, that's not a whole lot of room for comfort for the president right now. He's losing in all of these states.
And we do need to disclose that your publication has endorsed Joe Biden for president, although you are not part of that section of The Economist. You're a data guy. You know, and I want to ask you as well, you have a graphic on here showing how states move together. That as goes one state, a lot of, as you were just mentioning, a lot of other states with similar demographics will likely go as well. Can you talk a little bit more about how that works in presidential elections?
That's right. And statistically, what we refer to this as is correlated outcome. But it just means that states move together. It allows us to handicap what polls or election night surprises in one state might indicate for another. So we know, you know, historically that the demographic profiles of, say, Florida and Nevada, or even Florida and North Carolina, are pretty similar. They tend to vote pretty similarly, with the notable exception of Nevada recently getting rather Democratic-leaning. So when we get polling information that says Trump is gaining ground in Florida, this is just hypothetical, then our model would also say that Trump is gaining ground in these similar states, absent any other information about that state. Now, on election night, this is especially helpful, right? We're nearing the end of the campaign, so the polling analysis is, it'll be quickly irrelevant after 2 weeks from now. Mm-hmm. But on election night, the same correlations, the same relationships between states allow us to guess at what the election outcome might be based on results in similar states, because it would be unlikely, right, for Joe Biden to win Florida but to lose a much more Democratic state like Wisconsin or Michigan. So that's how the states really move together in our forecast.
What would you say to everyone who remembers 2016 and they don't trust polling and methodology like what The Economist uses? They believe there are voters out there that won't necessarily tell a pollster the truth about who they'll be voting for, that we may be surprised again. What is your thought about that as someone who studies this data at a granular level?
Yeah, I would say two things. First, we need to calibrate our expectations for how accurate a poll can be. These are not oracular predictions. They're instruments for measurement. They're barometers of public opinion, really, just like a weather barometer, and those barometers can be wrong sometimes. To continue the analogy, right, if you get a systematic change in pressure, right, and like you did in 2016 with a late shift toward Trump, and you're relying on your barometric measurement from 2 weeks before the election, your poll 2 weeks before the election, you're going to miss the change in pressure. You're going to miss the swing toward Trump, and polls can't account for that unless you take a reading the day before the election. So in 2016, this was really the big error. It was a late shift toward Trump, and we didn't have enough polls to pick it up. Now, there were also some methodological flaws in some polls that undercounted Trump supporters. Most of those polls have fixed that flaw, but it speaks to another note about how imperfect polling really is, which is that there are surprising changes in voter behavior that interact with who responds to a poll that can make polls less likely to be right from one election to another that are pretty unpredictable. So that could happen this time again. Now, I'm a bit more confident in the polls than some people are in terms of this alleged shy Trump theory. We've done lots of research to reach the same actual respondents in different modes of polling, online, in person, or with a robocaller, with the idea that people would tell the truth to a robocaller or to an online survey where they're not actually interacting with someone. And we found no systematic differences between how likely they were to say they would support Trump or Biden than they did when they were interviewed by a live person or even in person. So we don't find a whole lot of evidence that people lie to pollsters. But again, they're imperfect.
They're imperfect. Let me ask you this. Other models have shown that Joe Biden would need to win by above 5% to survive accusations of voter fraud, improper mail-in ballots, court challenges, possibly some states changing their slate of electors in defiance of the popular vote in their state. So what about that variable?
Yeah, this is what we call outside the scope of our model. It's something that we can't measure historically, so our model doesn't necessarily take it into account. Now, there are some issues with polls and with election nefariousness, I should say, that we do take into account. So to the extent that voter suppression in the past has made the polls inaccurate, or to the extent that, you know, we've had faithless electors even in the past, our model can take that into account because it's observed in the historical error in the polls. But new sources of error, like a pandemic increasing mail-in ballot usage and a president polarizing mail-in ballot usage, and again, further, the Supreme Court saying that mail-in ballots received after Election Day in Wisconsin can't be counted, that type of error is not taken into account in our model, in our simulations, and it is a potential point of weakness for this analysis. So it's important for you and I to have this conversation where we say, you know, the models aren't perfect and they can't take into account a forecast for an election that's conducted unfairly. But it's also a powerful tool to measure if an election is unfair, because what we're doing is we're giving you the probability that Joe Biden would win under fair circumstances. And, you know, if we give him a 2 or 3% probability of winning in fair circumstances and he loses, it might say something about how he ended up losing, how unfair the process was. So it can be a useful statistical measure of nefariousness in the electoral process, even if that also means there's a bit more error in the prediction than we can quantify.
Well, I would encourage everyone to check it out online, because you do update it daily at The Economist, the presidential forecast, and data journalist Elliot Morris with us. Fascinating to speak with you. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, y'all.
And in a moment, we'll tell you how Stage Aurora is celebrating the community of veterans in Northeast Florida, especially female veterans on the First Coast, all this month, both on stage and virtually at events you can join. That's after this. Don't go away.
Jacksonville historian Abel Bartley recently participated in the virtual panel discussion, Civil Rights, Equality, and Racial Justice in the Age of Black Lives Matter. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Dr. Bartley. We'll visit Spook Hill and remember the TV show I Dream of Jeannie. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
There are hundreds of thousands of people right now stuck at sea. Workers on container carriers bringing goods, but not allowed off the ship.
Everyone deals with the uncertainty and the stress very differently. Some people really retreated into themselves.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How those seafarers are faring, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Aaron Sorkin. His new Netflix film, The Trial of the Chicago 7, dramatizes the infamous Chicago trial of prominent anti-Vietnam War protesters accused of conspiring to start a riot at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Sorkin sees some parallels between the political divisions of the late 60s and today. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Where could you find an active campaign to deter millions from voting? 4 years ago, that's what happened here. Those on the list were mostly black and lived in battleground states.
I'm like shocked that they had all the way down to, we need to deter that one.
This time, record numbers of people are voting, but could the same thing happen here again? That's next time on 1A.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Stage Aurora is honoring veterans this month, both on their stage and with other virtual events. The local theater that focuses on African-American productions received the NEA Big Read this year. That's an honor. They're presenting the award-winning production, The Things They Carried, about the Vietnam War, along with many community activities to celebrate veterans, especially women. I spoke about it with Dee Caranta, president of Northeast Florida Women's Veterans of JACS.
Dolores, thanks so much for being with us. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So tell us what's happening at Stage Aurora with their presentation of the NEA Big Read. They're going to present a beloved production, The Things They Carried. But there's also a celebration of veterans happening. What all's on the agenda?
Yeah, so Northeast Florida Women Veterans have partnered with Stage Aurora to present some discussion panels for a panel of Vietnam veterans and then three panels of women veterans called She Served. And that's going to be happening during the month of November. One of the things that we are going to be discussing is her why, asking her why she served. I think it would be very interesting even to the community to really understand why women really join the military in an environment that is mostly male-dominated. One of the other subjects would be women in combat, new ground, because as you know, women have not always served in combat, except maybe in the medical field. So we're going to talk about women in combat, and then the evolution of women veterans, how things have changed in the military for women veterans. And of course, we give credit to those that went before us to help make those changes happen.
This is really, this is really great stuff. This whole series of discussions, because it's in conjunction with the production of Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried. That was a finalist for the Pulitzer, and it was about his personal experience in the Vietnam War. And as we mark Veterans Day in November, it's really fascinating to hear you talk about this, because we do have a large veteran community in this area, but particularly the needs and issues around female veterans don't always get the attention they should.
That's true, but we're working on that.
Yeah, and this is part of it. This is going to bring a lot. What are some of the biggest issues you want people to understand that your community of female veterans is dealing with?
We always say women veterans have unique needs just by the physical makeup that they are. But I think what's important is that women veterans are not asking for special treatment, just equal. And that's what I hear echoing all the time. I just want to be treated fairly. And, you know, everything from the VA to supportive services in the community, they need to make sure that they're paying attention to those unique needs and making sure programs are available to meet them.
Now, this kicked off November 1st. It runs through mid-November, right? So there will be multiple opportunities for people to check out what's being offered at Stage Aurora.
That's true. I do want to mention there is a panel of Vietnam era veterans, those who have fought in combat. So we are going to address the things that they carried with that panel of veterans. And that's happening. I'm sorry, my computer is a little slow. But we're going to address that. And then the women are going to be speaking on the 2nd, the 9th, and the 10th of November.
So lots happening, and I encourage people to check out the full schedule of events at stageaurora.org. This includes book discussions, live roundtables, and theatrical presentations. As Stage Aurora Theatrical Company presents the NEA Big Read, the Pulitzer Prize finalist Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried. Check it out as we mark Veterans Day this month. And I want to thank you so much for giving us your insights about this and the community of women veterans in our area. She is a veteran, Dolores Moten Caranta, and also president of the Northeast Florida Women Veterans of Jacksonville, partnering up with Stage Aurora. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it, and have fun.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate you having us on.
Again, stageaurora.org. Check out those events all on Zoom. Well, tomorrow's the big day, Election Day. And can you believe 60% of voters across Duval County have already voted early? Turnout is massive across Florida and the country. And if your vote is still yet to be cast, make sure to do it tomorrow on November 3rd. And make sure to tune in to 89.9 tomorrow night, beginning at 7 p.m. for our special Election Day 2020 coverage with yours truly and a panel of experts. We'll be live on the radio from 7 to 8. We'll be streaming live on our WJCT Facebook page on video. We'll also have live television cut-ins on local and regional results on WJCT TV. You can follow the results on our website all night too at WJCT.org. So make sure to vote and make sure to join us tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep your emails coming to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Catch our podcast later today wherever you listen or our rebroadcast tonight at 8. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow as we cover Election Day and then all through the evening and beyond. Make sure to get out and vote tomorrow if you haven't, and make sure to wear your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.